shores of El Pacifico, Phil Hendry.
Welcome back here to the world famous Phil Hendry Show here this Wednesday night from the El Pacifico, now Thursday morning. And welcome to the only news talk and entertainment show that knows what the hell it is it's talking about. Frankly, the only news talk and entertainment show that knows what it's doing. I mean it. And that is here to entertain you if we can, if you're entertainable. We're here every night until 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast, and join us online as well at philhendryshow.com. That's philhendryshow.com, where you can get a live video cast of the show, which is happening right now from the El Pacifico. Bud Dickman and Robert Leonard are going to join us here for our News and Information Hour. And that was I was listening to some music during the break. You're always interested, Bud, in the music.
Yeah, you're always playing that guy, Butterman or whatever his name is.
Yeah, what, is that Paul Butterman? Paul Butterman? No, Paul Butterfield. Paul Butterfield.
Butterfield.
Yes. But what is about that guy? I just like the music. It's blues. I like the blues. I like rhythm and blues.
What about white people like blues? All black people are put, but we don't play that stuff anymore because we don't be reminded of how bad stuff is, you know. We play this like hip-hop music and maybe, you know, some light rhythm and blues, you know. But I don't want to hear that blues.
Yeah, you guys, black people don't listen to blues no more.
What do you mean black people don't listen to blues no more?
I'm just telling you, man, we don't want to hear all that. That reminds us of bad days. We want to know some good stuff. You know, how about the good old days now?
Well, all right. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, it is true that the blues bands that came up, say, from the 60s forward were primarily white artists, and they were white artists that had fell in love with the music. You know.
Maybe they were white people that were picking cotton, too.
No, man, they didn't pick no cotton. That one guy, Paul Butterfield, his dad's a lawyer, right?
Well, if you don't know who that guy is, how do you know so much about him?
I just know his dad's a lawyer.
We looked it up on Wikipedia.
Oh, you looked it up on Winklepedia, huh? You mean Wikipedia?
Whatever.
Yes, his father was a lawyer. Yes, Mike Bloomfield was a guitar player in that band. Yes, he came from a well-to-do family. Yes, that's where a lot of the young white blues artists of the 60s, 70s, and forward came from. They came from middle-class homes. They listened to the music, and they liked it. But I can tell you, as has been so often pointed out by many of the, you know, many of the great classic artists, the Muddy Waters, for instance, Lightnin' Hopkins, these guys you're talking about?
Yeah. Those guys, I mean, they got reason to have the blues because they come up at a time when it was bad.
Okay, fine. But even they have said, I think anybody who has played the blues for any length of time will say anybody can have the blues if that's what it is that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you have to have the blues to play the blues.
All right, you're telling me that people don't get depressed? White folks?
Well, no, I mean, they never picked no cotton.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, if they ever picked any cotton.
What do you mean if they ever picked any cotton? In other words, to play the blues, you got to pick cotton.
But I'm telling you, the original guys, like Leadbelly.
Okay, Leadbelly, yeah.
All right, and Muddy Waters, the guy, all them cats pick cotton. But ain't one white boy I know who picked cotton.
You know, I'll tell you who did pick cotton. I'll tell you who, but they're not a blues band.
Who?
They're that group from Texas, and they were itinerant pickers. They were itinerant sharecroppers, and they're white people, but they sang in a gospel group.
Yeah, what's the name?
I think it's Johnny Cash and June Carter. No, I'm kidding.
Johnny Carrot!
No. I forget who they are, but a lot of those white gospel groups come from that. You're talking about coming from poverty.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. How come they ain't singing the blues? See, that's the thing. And so the blues is specifically, you know, I think it's black music. I know white people play it. I know they play it good. But I think if you're white and you have the blues, you play gospel music. If you're black and you have the blues, you play the blues.
Yeah, that's probably true. If you're white and you have the blues, you're going to want to go to church, whereas black people don't.
What's that supposed to mean?
Well,
will you just quit while you're ahead, will you? You guys come up with some of the screwiest commentaries on life and history and culture I've ever heard in my life. So if you're black and you have the blues, well, you play the blues. If you're white and you have the blues, you play church music.
Well, no, not but white gospel.
Yeah, southern style.
Yeah, southern fried style.
Southern fried style. I think both of you guys ought to go in for CAT scans. I think there's a tumor at work someplace.
Probably even as sick as Dick Clark.
don't bring that man's name up in any jesting fashion. Do you understand me?
Well,
don't you bring his name up in any joking manner today. He passed on today. Do you understand?
Yeah, how come Opie and Anthony get to do it, but we don't?
I don't care. If Opie and Anthony want to do that, that's their business. We ain't going to do it. What do you mean, how come Opie and Anthony get to? How do you know they did?
But he was on Twitter anyway.
Fine, great. I met Dick Clark. Did I tell you guys about this?
Yeah, about 100 times. But, you know,
all right, well, okay, so fine. Well, I don't think I told the audience. But I met him back in 1990. It was the one and only time I ever met him. And it was at a period in my career where, I don't know, I was going to these meetings with television people. And so what happened after that, man? I think that's when we did our podcast. But anyway, so I went to a meeting. They said, there's a guy over at Dick Clark Productions that has an idea that they, you know, we want you to go and listen to. It's a very nice guys. But here's what happened. I thought it was, the whole meeting was really interesting. It was fascinating to me. I go over to Dick Clark's office, which was over there in Burbank, and I think it was on Riverside or Olive, one of those streets, one of those main streets that cuts through Burbank that's a couple blocks off of, say, oh, I don't know, what the studio Warner Brothers is over there and the Disney Studios over there. And we pull in, and I go into this building, and I suddenly realize I'm in what used to be a restaurant because it's like you're in a restaurant. Now, they did put up offices, but part of the restaurant is still very recognizable because where I wound up finally meeting Dick Clark was in this meeting room that was very obviously at one time a lounge.
How'd you know?
Because the bar was there and some of the tables were still there. It was very interesting that they took over this restaurant and turned it into this office, the Dick Clark offices. So while I was waiting for him, we were in this room where we were going to have this meeting. I was waiting for Dick Clark to come in. I looked around the room, and I saw very interesting stuff there. There was Bobby Darin. He had framed the original, in some of the frames, original contracts that he had signed with some of the artists. And right there was the original framed contract of Bobby Darin's first appearance on American Bandstand.
What year was that?
I don't know, man, like 57 maybe, something like that. He had another one that was framed. I think it was, Frankie Avalon and some of these cats, Bill Haley and the Comets, that kind of a deal. And then he had pictures of himself as a young man very, very early when he was doing the American Bandstand back in Philadelphia when it was a local. I don't know if people know that, but it was a local show.
What was a Beachnut Theater? A lady called up and wanted to know about it.
A lady called up and said what?
You want to know about a what?
The lady called up and said, what's the Beachnut Theater, what he did?
The Beachnut Theater. I think it was a theater in New York where they originally moved the Dick Clark show from Philadelphia to... Did they move it to New York? I don't know. Yeah, it was in New York, the Beachnut Theater. And I don't know what the hell he was doing. Was it the American... I don't know.
I don't know either, man, but the lady said for sure the Beachnut Theater, then down in New York.
Well, whatever, man. You know, Dick Clark, I mean, that cat was... He was all over the place. I mean, let's face it. He had more irons in the fire. That guy had more stuff going on. He was a smart guy, man, because I heard him talking one time. Well, let me just finish up the story. So we were there, and then in comes Dick Clark with one of the associate producers there. I forget the gentleman's name. He's a very nice man. And Dick Clark walked in, a nice guy. First thing he said to me was, you are one crazy MF. And
Dick Clark said that to you?
Yeah, and he said it in a very nice way because he'd listened to some of our CDs. I said, thank you very much, Mr. Clark. And he was laughing. And I guess he'd been listening to my stuff that morning or something. He was talking to his wife about it. He was living over on the beach. And he came and he's very... the first thing that strikes me about a lot of people in showbiz that I meet for the first time is they're short. They're small guys. Dick Clark was he was a small man. Now, I ain't saying he was, you know, a midget or anything.
I'll tell.
Well, the cat had to be about 5'7 or 5'8, maybe 5'9. Hold on. Excuse me, folks. It's that time of the night when
all the allergies are kicking in.
Well, Bud, you know, what is it with you and that incense?
I don't know. It smells good.
When you light that incense, man, it's like comes into the room, and I know it smells good, but it jacks with my throat. Hold on. Sorry, I had to go to dead air there. All right, so very nice man. And as we talked, he said, "Now, Phil, we have this idea," and he went through this idea with the other gentleman. I listened to it, and I'll never forget him saying to me, "He says, now, Phil, you know how Dick Clark had that voice. He says, you can take it from me. I don't know. You know, if you want, take it from a man who's got 50. I think at that time he was in his, he was 72, 71 or 70, something like that. And I'll never get him saying, now, Phil, you can, I think it's a great idea, Phil. You can take it from a man who's got 50 some years in the entertainment business, but that's my idea, you know? A great way of putting it, because obviously he did have, he said 50. I mean, that would have made him, he would have been a disc jockey. He's a very young young guy. So, and then the other thing he said, and this, of course, was the beauty of Dick Clark. He said, now, if you guys, this is an idea, and it was an idea. Now, you know that if you say, okay, well, let's do this, you know that you're doing this with Dick Clark. And I know it's 12:16 here on the West Coast, so I'll hurry this up, Dan. I'm sorry. It will be produced by Dick Clark. And here's what Dick Clark did, and this is why he was brilliant. The name Dick Clark is all you need. You walk in and you say, we need this and that, or we need this and that. And he doesn't put out any money. He just pulls it all together. He takes a piece, and it's produced by Dick Clark. And indeed, it is produced by Dick Clark, because he brought everybody together, brought the talent together, brought the writers together. He brings together the whatever else you need in terms of producing and directing and actually physically putting the show on. And it, not one nickel is spent, but everybody wants to be in business with Dick Clark because he makes people money. So he doesn't put out any money. Everyone's spending their money. But in terms of the deal they strike with Dick Clark, they're going to make their money back and then some. And he gets a piece.
So did you do it?
Well, no, I didn't do it, and we can get into that. It had nothing to do with Dick Clark or not being totally wanting to do business with Dick Clark. We can get into that when we come back on the other side, because I know I have to take a break here.
No, come on, say it now.
No, I'm not saying it now, because the last time we took a break so late, Dan almost shot me. We'll be right back. World famous Phil Hendry Show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. World famous Phil Hendry Show.
Yeah, so anyway,
I'll just finish the story. So Dick Clark, we didn't do this idea just because there was, I don't know, it seemed like there were some other things that they wanted me to do, but I was very grateful to have met Dick Clark, and I thought he was a nice guy. He's a very nice guy, you know, and there's what do you call it? You know, some of these guys, you hear horror stories about them, you know?
Yeah, like when Howard Stern met Don Imus in a movie, it made him look like a douche.
Yeah, if that's really how Don Imus acted when he first met Howard Stern, I mean, that's no way he deserves what he gets. So anyway, Dick Clark gone. And then the other comments were made earlier about Don Cornelius. Yeah, I mean, he was fantastic. I love that show.
A lot of white people watch Soul Train. So they know what, you know, the real cool clothes are.
What are you talking about, the real cool clothes? The only ones that I've seen on Soul Train, what, so a guy can look like Superfly?
I'm talking about, no, not Superfly. I'm talking about, like, the really cool threads that the young black people wore. A lot of whites want to wear that.
Did they have any white people on Soul Train?
Yeah, they had some white dancers.
Yeah, they had, like, one token white guy who looked like he looked like he was in a Manson family.
What?
Yeah, they had a token white guy on the Soul Train show, so they could say, "Yeah, we got a white. Here's a white," and he looked like he had been in a psychiatric center.
Bud, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I'd like to know that.
You said they had been white dancers on Soul Train.
Yeah, one white dancer.
Well, no, they had a chick to dance with him too. She was white. She looked normal though.
But the guy looked like he came out of a psychiatric center on Soul Train.
What are you laughing about? I think it's racist against white people.
Oh, yeah, right, man, if it even happened.
Look, I know I saw white dancers occasionally. I don't know. I know that they had white artists. They had Tower of Power. which was about the dorkiest looking group I ever saw in my life on Soul Train, because they had these, most of the cats in the group Tower of Power, which is
what group's that?
They did a song called So Very Hard to Go, and
yeah, I know that song.
Yeah, and they did a couple of others. But anyway, they had a black lead singer, but the rest of the guys in the band were white, and a couple of them looked like some real dorks. So what I'm saying is, when they finally appeared on Soul Train, because the song was charting, and I think what we're talking about here is that songs that charted on what they called in those days rhythm and blues stations, because they didn't start using the term... what the hell is it? Urban contemporary, man. They didn't start using that for a long time. But or Churban, whatever. And so those are the songs that we're charting, you know. So they would have them on Soul Train. Some of them may be white. I don't know.
What other white groups they have on Soul Train?
I don't know, man. I didn't keep track of it. Why? Is it important to you?
Yeah, I want to know how integrated it was.
What do you care, bud? You're just trying to start an argument. Okay.
No, don't you think it's important?
No, I don't think it's important, especially when the question's coming from you. Okay? I'll tell you who they had that were white artists that were big on the crossover with rhythm and blues audiences. Tower Power is one. Tom Jones is another. You mean like modern?
Yeah, like groups today.
I don't know, man.
Jimi Hendrix.
Was Jimi Hendrix big with black audiences? That's an interesting question. I don't know. Was he?
Yeah, he was. Are you nuts? Of course he was.
All right. I mean, I thought it was interesting. You know, when I was coming up in music, and this is true, when I was coming up in rock and roll radio, when I was coming up in album rock radio, that's where I started. So I was an FM album rock disc jockey. All right. Now, album rock grew out of the old progressive rock, so on and so forth. But by the time I got into it, it was forget it. There wasn't anything freeform about it. You had the card file. They told you what to play. You know, you had to pretend like you liked it.
You had to pretend like you liked crappy music?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, that's why I stopped being a DJ. I couldn't take it any longer. I couldn't stand pretending I liked garbage. Now, I liked a lot of it, but some of it I hated.
Like, what'd you hate?
Well, I didn't hate it, you know, so much as I got sick of playing it over and freaking over again. If I had to hear Lodi by Creedence Clearwater Revival one more time, I was going to flip. They had to be, and Paul McCartney and Wings, I grew to hate that group. I hated them.
Paul McCartney, man, he was a Beatle.
I know he was a Beatle.
You're saying now, and you're saying it in front of everybody, that you hated a Beatle.
No, I didn't hate the Beatles. I didn't hate a Beatle. I got tired of hearing the same crappy music by that group.
Like what?
What was that song? Silly Love. Just a bunch of crap. So in any event, when we were coming up, I'll never forget this. I'll never forget this as long as I live. I think, did this happen? Yeah. We had a guy, he must have been the dumbest bastard the world has ever known. And I won't say the station. I will not say the company. I won't. But I will tell you the market that I was in. It was L.A. And we had an ownership group that was from out of town. Well, these jackasses come into town one day, and they said, we're going to start playing some rock and roll around here, because the preceding regime, the preceding programmer, it was a little half-assed. I mean, we played rock and roll, but I mean, there was some, they rolled in Bee Gees, and it was really weird, and it was sort of, it was the disco era, so nobody was really sure what you're supposed to play in rock and roll. And these cats come in and go, we're going to start just going back to rock and roll. And we're like, that's cool, you know, that's great. On top of everything else, the guy said, and we're going to let you guys choose your own music. How do you like that? And we're like, wow, this is awesome. Okay, great. But here's what the guy says. He says, now, rock and roll, you know, we don't play black artists. I'm telling you, I heard this.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. And the dude went in like an idiot because he didn't get... There were certain black artists that were always big with rock and roll audiences. Hendrix, Sly and the Family Stone, and there's a few others, okay? There were black artists that crossed over to white audiences really well. Hendrix and Sly were two, and there were others. This guy goes into the music library and takes out all the Hendrix. Can you imagine?
You're talking about Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. And that's when his whole announcement about you guys can play all your own music and we're not going to control what you play, it was completely meaningless, because I'm working for a real imbecile here. All right, we'll be back with more of this stupidity. And this is what Dick Clark has passed on at the age of 82. So we're, you know, back into the world of music and radio and all that stuff. The world famous Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry.
Welcome back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show. I was just thinking of some other groups that we played. Chambers Brothers we played. Earth, Wind, and Fire we played.
Earth, Wind, and Fire? That's totally black radio.
What, you play Earth, Wind, and Fire? We played Earth, Wind, and Fire. We played them. Yeah, they got play on Album Rock Radio. So did... I mentioned Marvin Gaye. I'm thinking... Oh, the Brothers Johnson. Remember the Brothers Johnson?
I think so, yeah.
Brothers Johnson. We played the hell out of them. Now, I don't know. I think it just was the fact that white audiences responded to those groups. But also, you know, when you talk about album rock, it had its roots in the underground rock of the late 60s. So it all had to sort of have a vibe, you know, a kind of a rock and roll countercultural vibe. So maybe that's why. All right. Let's move on from that. Because here's a story here that, quite frankly, now, is this the only article that you've got, bud?
Yeah, that's the only one that came up on account of that's what it was.
That's the only one that came up on account of that's what it was.
Yeah.
Well, here's page two, because I was missing a page from Ted Nugent to meet with the Secret Service. Rocker, and this has got nothing to do with, I don't think it has anything to do with the Secret Service in Colombia, but this is important. Because Ted Nugent... And you can be, you know, I like the fact that he's pro-gun. I like the fact that he's NRA. I like all of that. I got no problem with that. I don't like it when a guy starts getting over the freaking line with some of his comments like he made about Obama and the president. Way over the line and bespeaks stupidity. Rocker and gun rights champion Ted Nugent says he will meet with the Secret Service on Thursday to explain his raucous remarks about what he called Barack Obama's evil, America-hating administration, comments some critics interpreted as a threat against the president. Nugent told radio interviewer Glenn Beck, "The conclusion will be obvious that I threaten no one." Nugent said he'd been contacted by the agency and would cooperate fully, even though he found the complaints silly. The controversy erupted after the self-styled Motor City Madman made an impassioned plea for support for Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney during the National Rifle Association meeting in St. Louis last weekend. "We need to ride into that battlefield and chop their heads off in November," Nugent said of the Obama administration. He also included a cryptic pronouncement: "If Barack Obama becomes the next president in November again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year." Now, that's just flat, stupid stuff. And what that does is, it first of all, Ted, you know, I sort of held a little bit of admiration for you, given your support of gun rights. But now I just think you're just another dumbass celebrity. You stupid bastard. How else are they going to read comments like that?
What do you say?
Didn't you just hear what I said?
You didn't hear him?
No.
He said, "If Barack Obama becomes president... the next president November, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year." Now, you may be raucous, and you may be unhinged, and you may be groovy, and you may be the Motor City Madman, but that is an irresponsibly, ridiculously asinine statement to make when you can't explain it, and there's no way he can explain that.
Well, you gotta let him give a chance.
Well, he says he's going to talk to the Secret Service. I know exactly what he's already gave a hint of it. He said, "Obviously, I was overstepped. Obviously." Let me tell you something. When guys like that talk like that, and then they come along and they say, "Oh, well, I wasn't serious." Basically, what they're saying is, "I really don't know what I meant by what. I have no idea why I said what I said. I have no idea how I would possibly defend what I just said. So let me just say that I was kidding." Outraged Democrats circulated the remarks and suggested, let me tell you something, I'm a guy, who is outraged, circulated the remarks and suggested they were threatening. Secret Service spokesman George Ogilvie confirmed that the agency was looking into the matter but declined to give details. We are aware of the incident. We're taking appropriate follow-up. Nugent said he was simply trying to galvanize voters. Got me to think twice about voting for Romney. I've been saying all along that if Romney is the candidate, I'll vote Republican. But now, Nugent, you got me thinking twice. I'll tell you one other thing, and I'll tell you why. Because if he's got jackballs like you supporting him, but I'll tell you one other thing that's got me thinking twice about Romney. This whole stance that he's got on abortion and prenatal sonograms and all that, he better get his act together or I ain't going to give him my vote. I don't see, to me, that stuff's important, but...
What do you mean? He's pretty conservative.
I like the economic policies, but if he's socially, he's going to start taking stands like that. He's going to be just another moron. You know what? I'm not willing to sacrifice my vote for that. I'm getting sick and tired of that stuff. Either get with it or become a Tea Party member and come out and show your stripes and say who and what you are, Romney, and quit fooling around with this whole idea that you're some kind of a moderate. Nugent said he was simply trying to galvanize voters. The hard rocker, best known for 70s hits like Cat Scratch Fever, is a conservative activist and has a history of heated and sometimes vulgar criticism of Obama. Nugent endorsed Romney after speaking to him last month. Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz called on Romney to condemn Nugent's violent and hateful rhetoric. Romney spokeswoman Andrea Saul addressed the issue with a brief statement. Divisive language is offensive no matter what side of the political aisle it comes from. Mitt Romney believes everyone needs to be civil.
Well, that's that, man. Romney, he condemned that.
Yeah. I think Ted Nugent is really cool, you know, but his whole gonzo thing. Hey, that's great, Ted. You know, I know you're gonzo and hey, woo, you know. But guys say stuff and they don't know how dumb it is. And maybe it's because, you know, we in the broadcast industry have well, I shouldn't even say that because there's guys that do what I do for a living and they're almost as stupid as Nugent, maybe even more so.
They'll come out and say something just as dumb as that.
Oh, yeah. No, without question. It never ceases to amaze me. Guy going to say something like that, and then, you know, maybe it's because the feeling of ask forgiveness, not permission, is pervasive. And, you know, I agree with that to a point. But, dude, that's the kind of stuff that's going to get your ass thrown off the air if you do it on the radio. It's the kind of stuff that's going to get your ass canned. And then, even then, if you want your gig back, you got to explain it. Okay, no problem. You know. But, you know, if I say that, man... I got to know why I said that.
Why would you say that?
I wouldn't say it.
Yeah, but if you did say it, how would you explain it?
What do you mean if I did say it?
If you was Ted Nugent, how would you tell him to explain that?
If I was Ted Nugent, how would I tell him? First of all, what he said was, if Barack Obama becomes the next president in November, I will be either dead or in jail this time next year. That's what he said.
Yeah, how would you tell Ted Nugent to explain?
Here's what I would say. I would say what I meant was I would go on a bender the likes of which would either kill me or put me in jail.
Yeah, but then they'd say you'd get drunk driving.
No, I'd say I'd go out and I'd probably get so drunk that they'd throw me in jail. I'd have to say something that's got nothing whatsoever to do with threatening the president. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with anything having to do with, you know, violence. That's what I'd say. What I meant was I'd go on a freaking bender. And, by the way, Ted, I don't know when you're meeting with the Secret Service. If anybody is with the Ted Nugent organization, campaign, / association, / compound, here's a real good thing that he can say to the Secret Service. Guys, all I meant was, I'm going to be so drunk, I'm going to go out and get so drunk that I'll either kill myself with the amount of alcohol that I drink, or they'll just have to put me in jail to sleep it off. That's what I meant. I didn't mean anything. I'm really sorry, and I don't mean to put you guys out. That's what I mean. I don't mean any harm by anybody. I'm Ted Nugent. I'm a party animal. I'm a rock and roller. All right, in other news, did you see the... this is hockey news, by the way.
Yeah, I'm talking about hockey, man.
Are you getting into hockey?
Yeah, I like it.
You're not allowed to like it. Only white people can like hockey.
Hey...
I'm only kidding.
Only white people, huh? There's more and more there are more and more black players in the National Hockey League now than ever before, and black fans, too. So Sidney Crosby at last found a way to silence the Flyer fans that love to hate him from warm-ups to the final horn. How? Crosby and the Penguins dished out the kind of punishment they can only hope swings the series back their way. They were pushed to the brink of a sweep. Crosby and Malkin and Jordan Staal, all these guys. There were 9 goals in the first 2 periods of a 10-3 win over the Philadelphia Flyers Wednesday night in their opening round playoff series. Now, this is after they had lost 8-4 on Saturday, I think it was, to the Flyers. The reason why I'm bringing up this story is because the fights in this series, and especially that game last weekend, have been almost constant, nonstop.
Now, what's the thought of the fight, man? They let them fight?
Yeah, they let them fight, but if they fall on the ice, then they don't get to.
Well, that's only part of it. See, in hockey, I know a lot of you are hockey fans, but a lot of you are not hockey fans. Probably more people are not familiar with hockey, and I'm not either. So I have to absorb this by osmosis. But from what I understand, in hockey, you are allowed to swing on another player who is also engaged. That's the first thing.
But what do you mean engaged?
Like to be married.
Not to be married. I mean, a guy engaged in the fight. Engaged.
What a jackball, man.
That's what I thought.
No. No. First rule is if you're going to fight, the other guy has to be fighting back. If the guy is not fighting back, if he doesn't want to what they call engage, if he's backpedaling, if he's moving his body to the side, and it happens, then and you continue to swing on him, now you are involved in an infraction of some kind, a foul of some kind. If, however, both players throw the sticks to the ice, which is generally a sign that they want to fight. You toss your stick to the ice, and now they're swinging. Now they're in a fight. And once it hits the ice, as you were saying, Bud, that's generally when the referees will step in and break it up.
They let them keep on fighting if they're standing up?
I don't know. Maybe. That's the part I don't get. It looks like they let them go for a long time if they're still on their feet. If they're still on their feet, they'll let them keep wailing and wailing and wailing until it looks like one guy or the other is probably getting his ass beat to a pulp, and then they'll break it up, you know?
Just like in regular fighting.
Well, look, man, I mean, I don't know. But fighting is a part of the game of hockey to the extent that it is a reasonable defense, I guess, of your play, of your team, and so forth. You're not necessarily, you will get a penalty, but it isn't one of these things where your ass is thrown out of the league for like weeks at a time. All right, so there's that. Then the other thing is, I mentioned about the guy. The other thing is, you're not allowed to check a guy whose back is to you. You know what I mean by check?
That's when you hit a guy.
Yeah, but you got to hit a guy with your shoulder. You can't hit a guy with the stick. You can't have the stick up above the neck. You can't hit a guy with an elbow or a fist. You have to hit with a shoulder. Check with a shoulder. And maybe you can hit him with a stick if you're below neck level. But he's got to be facing you. And what happened in one of the games I was watching this weekend, the guy turned just around enough so that this dude could slam right into him. And I mean, he knocked this guy on his ass, almost knocked him out. In fact, I think he did knock him out. And it was a clean hit. But if the guy's got his back to you, you're not allowed to do that. This is just the stuff that I'm picking up, you know. But I was able to pick it up because this game the other night.
Well, I saw you watching that game. And I didn't know they had that many fights.
Well, I mean, the first period alone, man, they had like 5 fights or something. Pittsburgh came into that game believing that they could physically intimidate Philadelphia with their fight. What happened? It backfired on their asses. They got their ass kicked. They were wailing on the Flyers. They got all kinds of stupid penalties. That penalty I was telling you about where if the other guy is not engaged in the fight, well, one of the Penguins was wailing on one of the Flyers, and the Flyer player was not engaging in the fight. He was backpedaling. He had his turning his body to the side, and the Penguin player that was you know, slugging this guy, they threw his ass in the penalty box. The Flyers got a power play out of it because they take a player off the ice.
That's what I don't get. They take a guy off the ice. You might as well just give it up.
No, man, because you got to just play a different style.
Yeah, well, that's it exactly. It's not that you know, if you take a player off the ice in hockey, it doesn't mean that you're, oh, God, you're dead and they're going to for sure score a goal. It just creates a different style of play.
Well, what do you mean?
Like it's in your end of the ice. You know, first of all, you know that if you have a man missing off the ice, you're going to have to play a defensive game, and it's probably going to be down in your end of the ice. And so that's what you play. And the best you can do is to clear, as they say, clear the puck out of there, which is to throw the puck down to the end of the ice.
I don't know, man. Now, me, they want to have fight, and they like roller derby.
No, it ain't like roller derby.
Roller derby's bitching. You ever seen that?
Yeah, that's the dumbest thing I've ever. I don't even know how they score in roller derby.
Oh, come on, man. Roller derby?
Roller derby's the best. Roller derby beats the hell out of hockey.
Roller derby?
What are you laughing about? My uncle was in roller derby.
He was? What did he play?
My uncle played for the L.A. T-Birds.
Your uncle played for the L.A. T-Birds?
Yeah.
What was his name?
I don't know. Dickman.
Dickman, I know that. What was his first name?
Yeah, what was the first name?
Larry.
Larry Dick. Larry Dickman's the guy that Clint Eastwood asked about in The Gauntlet. Larry Dickman.
Well, something like that.
Your uncle was on... Seriously, was your uncle on the L.A. T-Birds?
Yeah, that's my mom said.
Is it your mom's brother or your dad's?
My dad.
No kidding. Well,
just I think.
Yeah, uh-huh. You know what, man? I'm going to let this little story sit for a few days. We're going to find out you didn't have anybody on the L.A. T-Birds.
What was the L.A. T-Birds?
The L.A. T-Birds. Oh, we got to take a break. The L.A. T-Birds was a roller... What do you mean, what was the L.A.? It was the roller hockey.
Probably the L.A. Dickmans.
Yeah, the L.A. Dickmans. All right, we'll be right back. World famous Phil Hendry Show.
Truth the LA is our Dickmans. Bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
I go to roller hockey. You want to go see roller hockey?
Roller hockey?
World-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Oh, we're doing a little split screen here on the website tonight here on our video cast. What I've got here on our webcast is the... This is cracking me up.
The L.A. T-Birds?
Yeah!
That's the L.A. T-Birds. And by the way, bud, no, I'm not going to look for your uncle.
Gotta be in there somewhere.
Great. You can look for him after the show. But this is some kind of a tribute page to the L.A. T-Birds. But the thing that I thought was really fascinating is I'm going to go down here, and you can see right there that Channel 5. That guy there is Dick Lane. And my God, if you grew up in L.A., you have nothing but the fondest memories of Dick Lane, because not only did he do the T-Bird games, this guy was beautiful. He started his roller derby broadcasting career in 51 and then joined KTLA and the T-Birds in the 60s. He was often assisted in the press box and the infield by Bill Hoppy Hout. The thing about Dick Lane is I remember him doing station announcing for Channel 5. But here's the thing. Lane not only did, he was this cat, he was like the all-purpose sports guy for Channel 5. So not only did he do the T-Birds, he did the wrestling.
That the guy, that one guy wanted to kill?
Well, the funniest thing I ever saw of the wrestling, and this was hysterical, Dick Lane was a guy already probably in his late 50s, early 60s, and he'd stand there with a microphone, Dick Lane here, you know, at the Olympic Auditorium, and we have the wrestling now. And then after the wrestling match, they would go to the locker room. And there's Lane talking to some badass, like the I don't know who the dude was back then, the Masked Marauder or something, you know?
Yeah.
And he would be like... You know, stop that. And he's talking to this Masked Marauder. Here's Lane with the microphone, all of like 60 or whatever. And there's this big hulking dude. And Lane's giving him crap. He's going, you know, you're nothing but a big lummox. And it was really, if you think about it, it was the prototype for today's WrestleMania, Raw, all that stuff. I mean, this was Lane, and every city had it. I'm not saying Dick Lane originated it, but all these guys were the prototype for what came after. You're nothing but a big blowhard, you know? And this dude, the Masked Marauder, or whatever his name was, he'd say, you know something, Lane? You know what I'd like to do with you? And he couldn't touch Lane, because, you know, obviously. But he would be so angry. He's just, I'll tell you, Lane. And this guy beat his head into the lockers.
Like the metal locker?
Yeah, yeah. He's just like, Lane, this is what I do to you. Bam, 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 bam. He beat his head into this locker. I'm telling you, he bent this locker in. And Lane you know, as part of the script, he didn't let up. He's like, oh, you don't scare me at all. You know, yeah, right. And, oh, Lane, what I wouldn't give. Oh, man, it was beautiful. And you're laughing, you know.
You're laughing? You didn't think the guy's going to crush Lane?
No. I mean, I didn't know, but I was a little kid, you know, 8 or 9 years old. I'm laughing my ass off because I thought it was so funny that Lane's just challenging this guy, the masked marauder. Oh, baby, it was a beautiful thing. Is that it? Okay. God bless you, Dick Lane. Well, I don't know when. We should have a Dick Lane. He died in 82. He retired in 72, and Dick Lane died in 1982. And Dick Lane, according to the Sizzy, belongs right alongside Vin Scully, Chick Hearn, and Dick Enberg as one of the great announcers in the early history of L.A. sport. I agree. I agree. Does he have a star on the Walk of Fame? God, he better. The world-famous Phil Henry Show is produced by Dan Northcraft and me, Phil Henry. And for all of your Phil Henry Show needs, make sure that you join us online at philhenryshow.com. That's philhenryshow.com. And get your backstage pass. Also, join us over there in our souvenir shop. We'll see you guys tonight. And what was that lockout, Dan, that we had? Oh, well. Let that be a lesson for you. There you go. That's our new lockout.
Phil Henry.
Yeah, it's great.
Thanks. Cool.